Hello and welcome to Behind the News. My name is Doug Henwood, and we're looking to do most weeks of this time at the worlds of economics and politics. Two guests today. In moments, Mark Ames talks about wage fixing and corporate libertarianism in the Silicon Valley. And then at the bottom of the hour, sociologist Alex Vitale talks about the theory and practice of policing, broken windows, militarization, and rampant racialized violence. First, Mark Ames. Mark first became known as a co-founder, along with Matt Taibbi, of The Exile, a fantastic alt-weekly they ran in Moscow together in the 1990s. He's now with Pando Daily, a webzine, which you can find at pando, P-A-N-D-O.com. He's been writing about Silicon Valley's scheme to repress wages for months now. On August 8, a federal court struck down a proposed settlement between the two sides, thereby allowing the suit against major Valley names like Apple and Google to go to trial. Mark Ames. The Silicon Valley wage-fixing thing, which you've been writing about for some months now, it has its origins in the movie business. So tell us, first of all, how this marvelous arrangement got started.
So this really started in 1985-1986, when George Lucas, Lucasfilm, spun off the computer animation part of his business. And this was financed by Steve Jobs. He had just got booted out of Apple around this time. And he spun it off to Ed Catmull, who today is a big name in Hollywood, and he's a Disney executive, and Steve Jobs. And when he spun it off, he struck an agreement with the heads of Pixar. So the computer animation part would be called Pixar. And he cut a deal with a gentleman's agreement, as they called it, with Catmull, and who's the president, and Steve Jobs, who ultimately was CEO and chairman of Pixar, in which they would not poach each other's employees, nor would they recruit each other's employees. And if an employee came to one or the other, that they would go over their heads and inform each other's, you know, executives. The idea was, in George Lucas's words, not to bid up each other's employee wages. As I dug into this part of the story, I realized this happens a lot in the computer animation business. This happened a lot in the 90s and the 2000s especially, where the heads of these companies, because as I discovered looking through testimony and documents, this eventually, at least in the computer animation industry, eventually DreamWorks Animation, Jeffrey Katzenberg's outfit, and other parts of Disney and smaller computer animation studios, they all wound up essentially getting on board with this George Lucas, Steve Jobs, Ed Catmull, wage suppression gentleman's agreement, as they called it.
Now, did this apply to people at the senior levels or rank and file coders? Who exactly?
Well, you mean who's affected by it?
Yes.
Everybody, which is kind of the amazing thing. Really everybody. And this is what happened when it moved into tech as well. All the way down to, I have emails about like cooks, you know, at Google and whether they can go to Apple and back and forth. I mean, really everybody.
You mentioned Katzenberg, of course, who's a good pal of Barack Obama's, right?
Well, you know, a lot of these companies were big Obama supporters. So when the Obama Department of Justice broke this thing open in 2010, settled in 2011, they did nothing to politicize the idea of wage fixing and, you know, monopoly power. They did it as quietly as possible. And of course, as is, you know, the case since the Clinton years, the settlement included no admission of guilt in it from any of the parties. But Katzenberg, as far as I could tell, we never got a comment from DreamWorks Animation. Katzenberg is the guy who's, I think, the largest bundler for Obama in 2012 and one of the largest in 2008. He's the guy that literally staged managed Obama's fundraising at that Hollywood dinner at, I believe it was George Clooney's house, where he raised $15 million by working the tables under Katzenberg's direction. And you know, this guy was flagrantly involved. These deals, these non-solicitation, which are really wage-fixing agreements, were worked out at the top only, at the very, very top, and only shared with a couple of senior executives, usually in the HR side. And it's impossible for me to believe, given what came out in the testimony and in the documents that the Department of Justice didn't know about DreamWorks Animation's role. And in fact, not only did they not get investigated, but you had Biden and the State Department lobbying hard on DreamWorks Animation's behalf a couple years ago. And today you have, what's it called, Oriental DreamWorks or something like that in Shanghai. It's like a $2 billion complex and a joint venture between some Chinese animation firm and DreamWorks Animation. It's the future for DreamWorks, they think.
You said there was some sort of settlement in 2011. What did that encompass?
It was a tiny little slap on the wrist. It did enjoin the executives named, including the executives of the seven main companies, which would be Apple, Adobe, Google, Intel, Intuit, Lucasfilm, and Pixar, the seven companies, enjoin the executives to regularly prove or show that they understand antitrust law for the next, I can't remember how many years, 3 years or 5 years, that they're following antitrust law and that they're not doing any of these sorts of antitrust violations, against their workers. But the best thing that you could say about it is it did stop it. The antitrust suit did break that open. And as far as I hear from everyone, they're not doing it today, or if they are, they're a lot more clever about it. And it did pave the way for this landmark civil suit, the class action antitrust wage theft suit that's going on right now. And that really is kind of a historical landmark case. It's historical for a lot of reasons, but I think the one that really sticks out is it's the first time, as far as people I've spoken to know, it's the first time that antitrust law, the Sherman Antitrust Act and I think the Clayton Antitrust Act, have been used to break up a wage-fixing cartel. We've become accustomed to associate antitrust law, certainly, let's say, since Ralph Nader came around or something, we've become accustomed to associating it with consumer rights, in a sense, right? So we kind of think, oh, if the consumer's getting screwed, then antitrust law maybe should be applied. We haven't thought of how the power of monopoly cartels can screw workers, or the power of, employer power, basically, and especially if they cartelize, how it can screw workers unfairly.
So how did Jobs transfer this model from the animation business to the broader tech industry?
Right. So this thing, this agreement was operational and going fine from 86 or so up until the early 2000s. And it stayed, as far as we know, within the computer animation industry. And then in 2005, early 2005, late 2004, what we see is the next big boom in the tech industry. And that boom led to the first really huge upside pressure on wages all throughout the valley for all the engineers, all the programmers and engineers and so on. I think that year, 2005, saw the largest upward tick in wages since the early 90s or something. And so Jobs, the first thing he does, as far as we get from the documents, he goes to Sergey Brin. This is right after Google went public. And he tells Brin that his people are, Google is recruiting Apple's people successfully. And he said, this is either going to stop and we're going to come to an agreement whereby we're not going to poach each other's employees, or we're going to go to war. And if you want war with me, believe me, you're going to suffer. I mean, he really comes across as an absolute sociopath in these private emails. And Brin's clearly freaked out by it. They're really in awe of Jobs. And you do get a sense from pretty much everybody all throughout the years that everybody's kind of in awe of Steve Jobs and really scared of him. He's an absolute bully to everybody. He bullies everybody into these agreements. And sometimes not successfully. In 2007 or so, when he was working on the iPhone, he tried to bully the head of Palm into joining this no poaching, non-solicitation agreement. And the head of Palm said, no way. A, this is illegal. B, it's unfair to our workers. And C, it'd be bad for my company. I mean, a lot of the iPhone engineers were initially poached from Palm, and then Jobs wanted to freeze it at that. And some of them came back to Palm to try to build a new phone for Palm. And so Jobs said, look, you don't have a choice. You know the power of Apple compared to the power of Palm. You know that it's a massive imbalance, and we'll slap you with all kinds of patent infringement lawsuits that you won't be able to handle, and you'll be over. And the head of Palm said, sorry, no way. And Palm doesn't exist anymore today.
Sounds sort of like what they tried with Samsung, except Samsung has some resources to hire lawyers.
Yeah. Yes. I know now when I look back at all these patent infringement suits, you know, you see how, I mean, on the one hand, you have sort of patent trolls who are these kind of like huckster upstarts in these different areas. But then you actually have from the other side, from the top down, it's just a weapon used to crush competition.
Oh, and so how did this all come to light?
Yeah, so I should go back a little bit. So Google basically agreed to join, and they agreed because of their cross-fertilized boards of directors. So you have, you know, Bill Campbell, who's this guy who was like considered a hero. In fact, I think my stories about Bill Campbell were the first one to kind of pop the bubble about this guy. His nickname is Coach. He's a Columbia football coach or something. And he's kind of like, I would almost say he's sort of like a Geithner figure in that all of these giant egos can all kind of work together through this character built Bill Campbell. So, you know, every Sunday, Steve Jobs would take a walk with him, and he also served, I believe he served on the board of directors of Apple. At Google, he was Eric Schmidt's personal advisor and sat in all board meetings and executive group meetings. And of course, he was also the head of Intuit. He sort of greased a lot of these relationships. And so when they needed to suppress wages as they were starting to rise, it was really Campbell who helped arrange them with Intel as well, and with a bunch of different companies. And he was able to calm Steve Jobs' ego. And eventually what I found, which was really shocking, was that by 2007 or 8, the agreement from the employer's point of view and from those who already had established sort of dominant monopoly positions like Apple, Google, Intel, and so on, from their point of view, this thing was working really well, and they wound up extending it and engulfing industries and companies all across the world. I mean, WPP, the PR advertising giant with well over 100,000 employees is listed in documents as being party to this thing. Microsoft, IBM, I mean, we're talking about hundreds and hundreds of thousands of employees, quite literally across the world, who to one degree or another were affected by this thing until it was broken open. And it was busted open in 2010. It's hard to say why. I mean, it seems to me, you know, around the time that it was busted open in the fall of 2010, at least when the DOJ went, antitrust division went public with it, at that time, Google was trying very hard to put the squeeze on Facebook, and they were starting to turn their sights on Twitter. And Facebook was resisting. They didn't want to be part of it because it wasn't in their interests. Steve Jobs, by this point, didn't have quite the bully juice, I think, that he did in the early mid-2000s. And so Facebook resisted it. And, I think they got sloppy. I mean, in the early days of this thing, in 2004, 2005, Eric Schmidt on of Google, his emails, you know, he would say, first he would say, let's not do this, this is illegal. Then he'd say, okay, let's do it, but make sure not to leave a paper trail. I don't want to get sued. And by 2006, 7, 8, these guys were just open about it, you know, and openly going around bullying everybody to try to join this thing, having people fired left and right for violating an illegal cartel. I think, you know, if it wasn't a Facebook or a Twitter or maybe some VC, you know, some VC investors whose startups were getting really destroyed by this, because, you know, when you have these big companies not able to recruit each other's employees, where do they get their employees from? They go to the startups and poach all the talent from there. So all the startups were dying. And so it could have come from, you know, really any quarter. I just don't think they were being very subtle about it anymore.
I'm speaking with Mark Ames, a writer for Pando.com. This sort of points up an interesting characteristic of the whole Silicon Valley governance structure. They all sit on each other's boards and pat each other's backs and basically sign each other's checks. It's a very tight little fraternity they've got going there.
It's very incestuous. And it's just amazing to me that it's allowed. The Clayton Antitrust Act specifically was written to ban that. And what happened in the Reagan years, you know, that was one of the main things the Reagan administration did, was to gut antitrust law and precedent and so on. And I think that was one of the law parts of antitrust law that they really went after and loosened up the definition of of what a competitive company means in terms of, because you're not supposed to have members sitting on the same board of directors who are from competing companies, right? Because obviously they're going to form a cartel like they did here. And they just decided, like, the definition of that is you know, something out in Mars. And so basically anybody can sit on anybody's board. And you really have that in Silicon Valley. And you have, you know, in the VC world, I mean, you have a lot of people who they just invest a little bit in every company. So the relationships really are very kind of incestuous like that. And my kind of anecdotal sense of that is that they really, a lot of them don't even really understand the problem with it.
It's funny, these guys, you know, they preach the gospel of disruption, but they want to have a firm control over their own environment.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, this is the part where they look a lot like the railroad barons, you know, who also preached, you know, radical laissez-faire for a while. And then they did disrupt or destroy, whatever word you want to use, you know, older industries and structures and the economy to their advantage. And now that it works more to their advantage and that they can extract rent from these new positions, they want to freeze it in and continue preaching free market to the rest of the suckers out there.
Which takes us to their ideology and their embrace of a kind of libertarianism. What do you make of their political philosophy these days?
Yeah, I would say that the more I've looked into it, you know, I think people have focused more recently on Silicon Valley libertarianism, tech bros, and all this kind of stuff. I'm getting a different sense the more I'm getting into the culture there and the political culture. What I'm getting is that at the level below the billionaires or the multimillionaires, the libertarianism, it's a very half-baked libertarianism. Even with a lot of the billionaires, it is. I think they see themselves as progressive, and that the libertarianism is some kind of sunny, optimistic, you know, appendage of progressivism. And I'm not even sure they know exactly what progressivism is. But when you push them on issues, on any issue, they tend to go really left, I think, and they tend to be very suspicious of capitalism, a lot more suspicious than you'd expect. So I think it's more like a suspicion of dominant power. And that's fair. That doesn't have to be libertarian. That could be populist, you know, and progressive also. But at the top, I think what you're seeing is with some of them, especially Google really stands out, and some of the others, you're seeing a kind of a very fast refinement of this libertarianism the other way, the right-wing way. I mean, Google, a lot of these people had supported Obama and see themselves as progressive on a lot of social issues and climate change and so on. But what Google and the others are discovering fast, those in these monopoly positions, is that their biggest problem, their biggest worry is antitrust law. And you see this here with this story. It's really what stands potentially in their way, even if it's just a weapon that is kept in a vault deep down below, you know, the Department of Justice and is barely used, it's still there. And, you know, there are good people working in the DOJ antitrust division and so on. It's a problem for them. And so you're seeing Google investing, throwing their resources in a huge way in the last year or two in the direction of the Koch brothers and Grover Norquist and that whole libertarian infrastructure. Because really that infrastructure is probably their best way to fight and destabilize and subvert antitrust law.
Well, it's funny because, you know, a lot of free marketeers actually do believe in antitrust law and are opposed to combinations and restraint of trade. So this is a very selective kind of laissez-faire they practice.
Yeah, it's the Koch brothers version, you know, where, I mean, I think it's more the neoliberal version, I guess, right? And it just happens to work really well for companies in a dominant position. I mean, this could be a subject for another talk, but, you know, when the Montpelerin Society was first established and they kind of first established neoliberalism, libertarianism in the post-war era, some of the first papers that Milton Friedman and I think Aaron Director were putting out took a more Adam Smith view of monopoly and antitrust. And their backers basically went to them and said, no, this is wrong. And, you know, these guys were in it for the money, so they went back and rewrote it and said, actually, there's really no such thing as a monopoly in the private sector because competition will always destroy monopoly. Monopolies can only exist in the public sector, and that's why they always have to be broken up and privatized. That works really well, that kind of thinking, and that thinking informs all of the, you know, the Cato Institutes and the Americans for Freedom and Liberty and Prosperity and whatever the hell they're called.
Adam Smith, who wasn't in it for the money, was rather acerbic on how when people in the same trade get together, they almost always concoct a conspiracy to fix prices.
Right. Yeah, he has some famous quotes about that. And, I think it was Barry Lynn's book, Cornered, there were a lot of conservatives, older school conservatives, who were kind of shocked by the gutting of antitrust under Reagan and opposed it and joined with Metzenbaum. I mean, guys like Arlen Specter and Danforth. I mean, guys were problematic in a lot of ways, but on this issue, they just thought, this is crazy. You can't actually have a free enterprise system or a free market system if you have monopolies. But for the people, for the real ideologues of this and for the smarter, you know, five-dimensional thinkers like the Kochs, this was about politics and the political economy, not about a free market and fairness, you know.
Yeah, and finally, you wrote up a conference, I guess, last month that the Silicon Valley people were having with some of the leading libertarian lights of the Koch variety. What happened there?
Well, what happened was Rand Paul was invited for a conference that they called the Conservatarian Hipster Conference, and it was held, you know, right there in the South of Market area where all the Twitters and everybody are located. It was sponsored by Lincoln Labs, which is the Koch's Silicon Valley arm, run by a couple of, libertarian conservatives out of Texas who kind of wormed their way into Silicon Valley. The Republican Party also set up another pretty high-tech outfit in Silicon Valley to kind of tap into their database technology and so on, and to recruit. And then they brought in some of my favorite figures also, like Nick Gillespie, the Fonzie of libertarianism, the guy with the leather jacket. Then you also had, on the other hand, one of the top persons in Sheryl Sandberg's Lean In organization, I think it was called. I think it was her top communications person from that. You know, you had these people from various Silicon Valley outfits. I think there was somebody from PayPal who probably consider themselves conservative or Republican. Probably don't, I'm pretty sure, don't consider themselves, you know, Tea Party Republicans, and consider themselves pretty progressive on social issues. And so I sort of went in and described really the kind of crazy anti-gay and anti, you know, evolution, anti-science thinking of some of the people that they invited there. And I also got into the history of libertarianism through Reason magazine, because Reason was really taken over by the Kochs, let's say, in 1970, 71. And since that time, it's been a California magazine. So it's been kind of the more progressive, mainstream progressive liberal end of the libertarian movement, and always had absorbed that side of California. And it also incubated a lot of ideas, which are today hugely popular in Silicon Valley. Back in the 70s, Reason magazine was talking about busting up the taxi company monopolies and replacing it with basically gypsy cabs, which is what we have now, thanks to Uber. They pushed for, you know, privatizing schools, school vouchers, all along since the 70s. They pushed for privatizing space in the 70s, which is Elon Musk's big thing. All of these things, which today's big shots in Silicon Valley think are their brilliant ideas, were found in the old issues of Reason magazine when it was in Santa Barbara. And it was published alongside all of this crazy racist defense and support for the apartheid regime in South Africa, which, you know, the gold bug side of libertarians saw as the incarnation of libertarian paradise, where a minority property elite ruled with a gold-backed currency over a bunch of socialist-minded savages. And so I brought that out, and that upset them a lot. And I also found, you know, I found an entire issue of Reason dedicated to Holocaust deniers. That's another story. I think what it really shows is Silicon Valley people, their libertarianism, such as it is, it's very half-baked, not really thought through. and not really challenged until now. And so I think you're going to see a lot more challenging where they really stand on stuff. And what we're finding out with Google, for example, is Google is moving hard right fast.
Well, it's funny, because, you know, you read Hayek, he's pretty explicit on the fact that freedom is really for an elite. It's not for the masses. And, you know, what you're talking about in Reason, too, like the defense of apartheid, you have the masses in some form of slavery with a small elite enjoying freedom in the libertarian sense. So it's a rather consistent position, but they don't really like to have the underside revealed to the broader public.
No, and you know, Robert Poole, who's been the head of, who helped found Reason, was the editor and so on. I mean, he admitted freely back then, at least, that his hero was Spencer, Herbert Spencer, you know, the godfather of social Darwinism. And if you think about, you know, William Sumner, who was sort of America's leading social Darwinist and a godfather of American libertarianism in the late 19th century, he had a pretty concise dictum that I think really sums up true libertarianism, which is that liberty is inversely related to equality. So the more inequality you have, the more liberty you have in a society. The more equality you have in a society, the less liberty you have. Don't ask me to explain it. Basically, why would you say that? Well, look at South Africa or, you know, anybody who thinks that liberty really means the ability to do whatever you want with your property and screw everybody else. That's liberty.
That was Mark Ames, a staff writer with the website panto.com. You're listening to KPFA and KPFB in Berkeley, KFCF in Fresno, and the web to kpfa.org. My name is Doug Henwood, and the program is Behind the News. Some of Funa Funa by Issa Mamwaya and Radio, I don't think I can say that word on the radio, from 2008's very best mixtape, complete with an ABBA sample. Next up is Alex Vitale. He's a sociologist at Brooklyn College who specializes in the study of policing, especially the country's largest and most famous cop force, the NYPD. The recent killing of Michael Brown in Ferguson, Missouri, and a few weeks earlier the death of Eric Garner, an asthmatic choked by a New York cop, made me want to put current policing in perspective. Additionally, the allegedly progressive New York City Mayor Bill de Blasio took office in January with a goal of reforming NYPD practice, which all too often revolved around harassing and sometimes shooting young black and Latino men. Part of the issue facing de Blasio was the ongoing life of the broken windows theory of keeping public order. The theory is first enunciated in a 1982 article in The Atlantic by James Q. Wilson and George Kelling. As Alex Vitale describes in this interview, broken windows theory led to a relentless policing pressure on poor neighborhoods that has had nothing to do with the drop in crime over the last 20 years, but has caused a lot of people a lot of misery. Alex Vitale. Before we talk broken windows, what about this business in Ferguson, Missouri? To someone, just a casual observer, it looks like the American police have collectively gone on a rampage of racist trigger-happy murder. Is this impression correct? Is this old news? Something new happening? What is it? Put this in perspective for us.
Doug, you're always one for subtle language there. I'm not sure that we're seeing a change in policing. I think perhaps what we're seeing is a change in the reaction to the policing. And I wonder if perhaps the strong reaction to the Eric Garner case maybe has played a role in what's happening in Missouri. It's no way to know that for now. But look, the over-policing of communities of color is not a new story. Violence against young black men by the police is not a new story. We all know the long list of names. I think what's changed is both the level of reaction at the community level and the receptivity to the story by the media. So one could easily have imagined, you know, a small amount of violence in a small town in the Midwest in a community of color being largely ignored by the media or covered only momentarily. But I think that, and this may be in part because of the New York-centric nature of so much of the national media, that they're already immersed in this discourse around policing and communities of color and injustice, that the Ferguson story, the Mike Brown story, has really taken on a larger life. But it's not a new story, but it is a very troubling story.
But of course, really nothing all that new except the reaction to it. I mean, there's not been an increased level of willingness to shoot, according to the statistics.
No, in fact, in some ways, shootings are down. And I've been adding this little hashtag on Twitter, you know, there's nothing special about Ferguson. You know, there's nothing special about these cases, tragically. In the Eric Garner case here in New York, at least, what was special about it was just that it was caught on video, but that these are sort of daily interactions that people have with the police. We didn't have a video in the Ferguson case, but I think there's just a level of outrage is brewing.
Now, is there something in the way that cops are trained that makes them predisposed to this sort of thing? Is it just the kinds of people who are drawn to police work in the first place? How do you explain this as a sociologist?
I don't think that's generally true. It's certainly less true of big city departments. Now, we do have cases in small city departments, small town departments, where you do have people who are just straight up racist, over-aggressive, are associated with right-wing movements, paramilitaries, the KKK. I mean, all of that does sometimes happen in small communities. But I think it's more the nature of the job. We're asking the police to perform a job that is inherently unjust. And once you start going down that road of doing things like enforcing the war on drugs, engaging in this over-policing of minor offenses associated with the broken windows theory, once you go down that road, your attitude towards the public that you're being asked to police, mostly a poor and non-white community, becomes aggressive. And the way that you maintain control in those situations is constantly upping the level of aggression. So even the best-meaning, best-trained police officer is going to find themselves in a situation where they encounter an increasingly frustrated, hostile, and resisting public, and they're going to respond to that by upping the ante. And that's what we're seeing in a lot of these instances.
Now, there's been talk of, and I think even some experiments with having cops wear video cameras on their badges or whatever to record and discourage this sort of thing. What do you make of that?
I think it's probably a positive thing. The consent decree, the ruling in the stop and frisk case, the Floyd case here in New York, called for the creation of a pilot program for the use of cameras here in New York. The public advocate, Letitia James, just came out with a strong statement in support of moving ahead quickly with that. These police departments are able to get Humvees and drones and armored personnel carriers. I think they can figure out the cost and the data management for some lapel cameras. So there's no excuse for moving forward on this. As long as there are some protections on the data so that they're not using it to create gang databases and intelligence files on people, but that the data is only there to be reviewed when there's a specific criminal matter or a complaint about police conduct.
Now, you mentioned some of the gadgets that the cops have gotten after 9/11, the war on terror, you know, the Humvees and the militarization of the police. Has that contributed anything to what seems like increased police violence?
the availability of military technology did not begin with 9/11. It was already well underway, and I've linked it, I think we discussed this once before, to the war on drugs and the development of SWAT teams, which is a product of the 70s and 80s is when that the momentum begins to roll around that. And a lot of this militarizing mindset really has been directed at the war on drugs and this idea that, you know, there's this evil force in the society and that if we just bring ever greater force to bear on it, that somehow this will bring about good results. But it's really been one of the prime mechanisms for criminalizing young people, communities of color, poor people, and has seriously eroded the Fourth Amendment, has been used to justify this incredible ramp up in arming the police. And so I think even before 9/11, this was a major problem.
Okay, you mentioned broken windows, so let's now turn to that. First, give us the intellectual history of the broken windows theory. How did it come to be so prominently accepted?
Well, you know, it's a product of the neoconservative turn of the 70s. James Q. Wilson was a well-known criminologist, but associated with very conservative urban thinkers. He was a student of Edward Banfield, one of the most conservative urban thinkers of the 60s, whose book, The Unheavenly City, really says, well, we ought to just abandon the cities to the people who are not able to get out of there, and just, you know, these people are all caught in a culture of poverty, and anyone who has the means to leave, why on earth would you stay? And we should quit coddling these folks because any kind of social benefits we give them will just be squandered. You know, well, Wilson was Banfield's student at the University of Chicago. They were all pals with Milton Friedman. Banfield took Wilson with him to Harvard, and they co-wrote things together. You know, at least Wilson didn't believe in blowing up the cities. He, like a lot of urban neoconservatives, many of whom came out of progressive Jewish communities but became disheartened about the direction of cities in the wake of the civil rights movement and the social disorder that they associated with that. And basically, folks like Wilson and Fred Siegel, Kelling's colleague at the Manhattan Institute, said, look, liberal politicians gave blacks too much freedom, let them get away with too much, and that's why we have disorder, that's why we have crime, and what we need is to restore moral authority out on the streets. It's the counter-narrative to saying, oh, well, what about deindustrialization, the abandonment of cities by the federal government? None of that gets discussed in this conservative narrative. So if you read Fixing Broken Windows, Kelling's full book about the broken windows theory, he says, you know, where does the disorder problem comes from? Oh, it's too much individualism. And what does he mean by that? He means the successes of the women's liberation movement, the civil rights movement, in freeing people and the sexual revolution, gay and lesbian rights, right? That unleashed too much individuality, and we have to clamp down on that in the name of communitarian kinds of values, which, of course, in his mind are white and middle class values.
I mean, that's funny given the association you mentioned with Milton Friedman, who was all about individualism, but I guess they're selective in their application of the doctrine.
Yeah, what they get from Milton Friedman, I think, is the idea that trying to use government to manipulate markets or provide a safety net is all just a wasted effort.
So broken windows itself associated zero tolerance policies. What did that mean on the street?
Well, you know, in the original writing of it, the idea was supposed to be that the cop, the beat, who knew people in the neighborhood, would gently nudge people into behaving in a more civil fashion, not necessarily arresting them, working in partnership with other social actors to, you know, create a Jane Jacobs-like, eyes on the street. But right from the beginning, in practice, what it meant was hyper-criminalization of poor people. So broken windows policing actually first gets underway in San Francisco as part of a backlash against homeless people, and it took the form of intensive ticketing and arresting of homeless people in public spaces. Its first application in New York that most people are aware of and has talked about is getting rid of squeegee men. How did they do that? Not by nudging them, not by providing social services, not by dealing with their problems, but by coming out and arresting them day after day after day, putting them in the criminal justice system. And so what it came to mean to police was criminalizing the problem through heavy police enforcement.
I'm speaking with Alex Vitale, a professor of sociology at Brooklyn College, who studies police forces, especially the NYPD. Now, the apologists will say that by taking such a zero-tolerance policy, they've prevented all kinds of crimes, and they take credit for the very sharp decline in the crime rate in New York and other major cities. They attribute it to this sort of policing philosophy. What do you say?
Well, I've said many times that you can use the broken windows theory to get rid of an isolated disorder problem like squeegeeing in. But don't try to tell me that that has anything to do with serious crime. Lots of research has been done. Bernard Harcourt has done some great work that shows that disorder and crime are not clearly linked. You can have disorderly places that don't have crime. You can get rid of disorder and still have crime problems. But more importantly, the crime drop is an international phenomenon that has taken place in cities all over the place, many of whom have never heard of broken windows policing. Many of them did not have a disorder problem to begin with. They had a crime problem. It's international in scope and can't possibly be connected in any meaningful way to changes that are specific to policing in New York City. The biggest sort of proponent or advocate of the role of policing in New York, Franklin Zimmering at Berkeley, said that maybe 20% of the crime drop in New York was specific to changes in policing. But even then, he said those changes were not the changes connected to the broken windows theory. They had to do with hotspot policing and the use of CompStat. So even their biggest booster says it had nothing to do with broken windows theory.
And also, as I recall, the incarceration rate in New York did not zoom as much as it did in other places, right?
No, it actually came down at times during our giant crime drop. We know there's no correlation between incarceration rates and the crime drop. Canada has also had a very dramatic, long-trending crime drop, and they had absolutely no change in their long-standing low incarceration rates. They had no increase in the number of police, and they never really heard of broken windows policing up there.
So what has happened to the NYPD? We have now de Blasio in office a bit over 6 months. What's happened under his administration?
Well, I think what's going on is de Blasio does have some interesting progressive objectives. They're not radically transformative, but given the sort of direction of urban public policy over the last generation, I think they're significant. And my guess is his advisor's feeling is that the one thing that could derail this agenda of trying to address some pretty significant inequalities would be an uptick in crime and disorder. So while they work on these inequality problems, they bring in Bratton to cover their right flank. The problem is that the policing that Bratton is invested in conducting is reproducing exactly the inequalities that they claim they're trying to address. And so I think maybe they hoped they could kind of tread water on the policing thing while they deal with after-school stuff and pre-K and some changes to the minimum wage and some other very positive things. The problem is the policing is just so out of control, not in a new way, but just in an ongoing way that's been happening for a long time. It doesn't look like it's going to be sustainable anymore.
What was Bratton's record like in L.A.?
He was seen, I think, as a very savvy political player who built alliances with important community figures, people of color, religious figures, etc., while at the same time, engaging in the kind of over-policing that we associate with, like, stop and frisk and broken windows policing here in New York. And while there was blowback on the way he dealt with the situation in Skid Row, the way he handled, immigrant rights protests, he was able to mollify key opinion leaders sufficiently. So he had a kind of mixed record. He enjoyed the international trend of dropping crime. And, of course, every police leader, no matter what method of policing they're using, is trying to take credit for that crime drop.
Now, you said earlier that one of the reasons that de Blasio appointed Bratton was to cover his right flank, a political maneuver, but was there any policy intention behind it as well?
Well, I think in the sense that de Blasio understands that disorder does matter. And I agree, disorder matters. Having people living in parks and subways, having people making public spaces unusable through either serious crime or low-level criminal disorderly behavior, that's a problem. Anyone who wants to live in cities like myself should be concerned about that. And the public in New York has been so convinced by the sort of Giuliani media nexus that broken windows policing was the reason that we got rid of the disorder problems of the 80s and early 90s, that he's like, well, let's not let the disorder come back. So let's have Bratton stay on top of the disorder. So I think in that sense, it's not just a kind of cynical cover, but it is a feeling of, we have to keep the disorder in check because we got more homeless people today than we had under Giuliani. We've got the same levels of youth unemployment. We got the same people not receiving adequate mental health or other kinds of health care. So the potential for a rebirth of widespread disorder is always looming out there.
Yeah, I was just up in Montreal, and I was struck by the visibility of poor and homeless people in public spaces in ways that we haven't seen in New York in 10 or 20 years. Where did all those folks go? I mean, it was just the police just keep them out of public view?
That's a big part of it. That's a big part of it. There was a rapid expansion of the population at Rikers Island, where it costs, like $500 a night to keep someone. It's extremely expensive to run that place. And there was a real shifting of people to the outer boroughs, to more out-of-the-way spaces, getting people to go into the shelter system rather than sleeping rough outside was a part of it, and also preventing groups from forming. So if you go to Midtown Manhattan tonight, you'll see homeless people sleeping in boxes, wherever, but by themselves. And that was very different than in the late 80s where people were setting up encampments. And somehow the encampment dynamic was much more disturbing to people, was much more of a sign of disorderliness, was much more visible than an individual who, after most people have gone home, sets up a few boxes, sleeps, and then gets up at 6 in the morning.
Going forward, the Garner case, certainly out of the country when it, so I missed some of the coverage of it, but I mean, it obviously was major news. Is this going to change anything in the way the NYPD is run under de Blasio, or is it going to be business as more or less usual?
I don't think we know yet. They have tried to stay the course, we're going to do some training. Training is not the issue here. As I said before, it's not like we can just do a kinder, gentler broken windows policing or a kinder, gentler massive over-policing of young people of color. That's not going to cut it. Because really, what has been interesting about the Eric Garner case is the extent to which people are not just reacting to the death, but reacting to the underlying policy. My first thought when this happened was it's going to be all about the chokehold and it's going to be all about police brutality. And so, I wrote a piece that appeared in the Daily News the next day trying to really drill down on the fact this is the result of a policy of over-policing in the guise of the broken windows theory and that's what has to be addressed.
And other police departments around the country, do they watch what the NYPD is up to? Is it an influential pace setter?
In some ways, yes, and in some ways, no. I mean, the New York, there's always the issue of New York exceptionalism. The size is so huge. The role of anti-terror stuff is so prominent. Not everyone could duplicate what we do in New York because they don't have the resources to throw at it. And I think, you know, what we're seeing going on in St. Louis is really a completely kind of analogous reaction, which is just that young people of color are tired of being over-policed. And so I think what police executives are doing this morning is looking at what's happening in Missouri as well and thinking about, you know, what is their relationship to these communities and what role is policing playing in exacerbating these problems.
As Alex Vitale, who teaches sociology at Brooklyn College, his book on the NYPD, City of Disorder, was published by NYU Press in 2008. You can find him on Twitter under the handle Avitale, A-V-I-T-A-L-E. Speaking of squeegee men, the cover of the New York Post the other day found one in Manhattan and blared out a headline that they're back. Such is the pressure on de Blasio from the right. Not that he's all that left, but still. That's it for me, Doug Henwood. Let's go out with this, Police State by the UK Subs from 1983. Till next week, bye.